History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should never go untold. And they don't have to, as long as we're willing to take a couple pretty simple steps. First, take that initiative to ask a few questions. And second, invest a little time to listen patiently as memories from long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these descriptions of situations none of us will ever find ourselves in. Very few of us, anyway, and I know inspiration's on the docket today with an incredible rescue story that can become a little more than a story for you if you happen to be at the right place at the right time. If you're a longtime listener to Hometown Heroes, you've heard a lot about the Honor Flight program, flying veterans free of charge to their memorials in Washington, D.C. And now that we've reached September, Honor Flights are revving their engines up again, and there's a good chance that wherever you're listening, there's an honor flight taking off there in your backyard soon. They're always looking for new volunteers to help support the mission, and even if you don't do that, just showing up to welcome a plane full of veterans back home is a pretty powerful experience. Take my word for it. I get goosebumps every single time. The Navy Cross recipient you're going to hear from today will be on his honor flight this next week, and maybe you'll have the chance to cheer him on. You can always find an honor flight hub in your area at honorflight.org, and just for example, if you're one of our listeners in the state of Washington, in Spokane or Tri-Cities on KSBN or KONA, Inland Northwest Honor Flight will send another group of veterans to D.C. on October 9th. A little further south in Oregon for our KYKN listeners in Salem, South Willamette Valley Honor Flight will take off September 28th. That group's even started a new podcast with the veterans that they take. It's called Valor Vault. You should check it out. I know we have some new listeners in Tennessee and Virginia on WABN, and Honor Flight of the Appalachian Highlands is getting ready for its fifth mission on September 22nd. In the Golden State, there are upcoming flights in the Bay Area, from the Central Coast, Bakersfield, and from the only airport in America with giant sequoia replicas towering in the terminal, Fresno Yosemite International. If you're there on September 13th to welcome home the latest mission of Central Valley Honor Flight, one of the decorated veterans you'll be cheering on has lived the half century with gratitude that he and his crew survived a very different kind of flight, an incredible rescue mission into North Vietnam that earned him that Navy Cross. Harry Zinser is 77 now and battling Parkinson's disease. You may hear that reflected in his voice a little. Back then, he was just 26 and only a few years removed from starring on the gridiron at Wheaton College in Illinois. Harry was the pilot of an HH-3A search and rescue helicopter aboard the aircraft carrier USS Saratoga with Helicopter Support Squadron 7.
I usually stayed up a little bit later, and I was the last one to go to Iraq, so before I retired for the evening, I went into CIC, this Combat Information Center. She says, hey, Lieutenant, let's go over here. Says, they're getting ready to launch one of your big mothers overland, to go overland for a rescue overland. I go, what? He says, yeah, South SAR, 2 miles to the south of us. We had a helicopter on board there. They're ready to launch them. And I says, Chief, that'll never happen. He says, we don't go overland. He says, yeah, they're getting ready to launch them overland. And the radios crackled. And we heard him say, Red Crown, that's call sign for South SAR. Said, Red Crown. He says, yeah, have you launched your big mother yet? I said, no, semi. Then they came back later, about a minute later. This is Red Crown. Says, our big mother's down. We heard a radio call. Says, break, break. Says, Oslo, this is Jehovah. Launch your big mother now. Jehovah's call sign for the Admiral when he spoke on the radio. We have people who have been through the entire Vietnam War. They never heard Jehovah on the radios. We heard him twice that night. First time was when he told the Red Crown to launch your big mother. She says, what? Yeah, it's the adjutant, Chief. I call your skipper. I said, emergency flight course, we have to launch. He says, I can't call my skipper. I says, why can't you call your skipper? He says, well, it's just orders not to bother the skipper at night. He says, you got to call him tonight, or I tell you, you won't have a job tomorrow. And I think I was right, because they called emergency flight course, and the CO was at the helm when we took off. I know he was. So I was the first one out to the helo. Had a flashlight with me. I pre-fired the helicopter. So I took the engine covers off. I got in the center seat, and I had number went in and started by the time my cobot got out there. So he says, what's up? I says, hey, we're launching. Now, back then, when you took off from a non-aviation ship, you could not land on it at night. We did not have night vision goggles back then at all. We could take off from a non-aviation ship, but we could not land. So I knew we were going to head back. I knew we'd be landing in the Midway, 200 miles away. We had 3 hours of gas on board. We fly 100 miles, about 100 knots. It took 2 hours to get to the carrier. But we had to stay low because we were up in Haiphong Harbor, and we had to fly below the radar. So we're about 10 miles off the shore. So we're flying at 500 feet. We have radio comms with the ship for about 30 miles. So we flew about another 40 miles before we had comms again. So I briefed our crew and said, what's up? I said, crew, the A-7 pilot has been shot down over North Vietnam. They want to launch our big mother to the south, but they're down, so they're launching us. So what are they launching us for? So I don't know. So we launched, and we're now the primary search and rescue vehicle. And I briefed them that he had been shut down about 2 hours ago. They had not heard from him. They had to come up on voice in order for rescue to be made. We knew the area where he was shot down, heavily fortified with the North Vietnamese Army, and so we thought he had been captured. But come to find out, he had not been captured. He's a pretty savvy guy himself. First of all, he got hit by a SAM missile. Surface-air missile. He saw one coming on his radar. He avoided it, but he got hit by another special one that he did not see. Usually what happens. He was going through 2,000 feet uncontrolled when he bailed out. Minimum uncontrollable safe bailout altitude, as I was told later, is about 10,000 feet for an A-7.
So the minimum safe altitude to bail out of an A-7 is 10,000 feet. If you're bailing out less than that, there's no guarantee that you're going to survive this. And you said he was only at 2,000 feet?
He was only 2,000 feet when he bailed out.
So the odds were not in his favor?
Not at all. Uh-huh. He said he got about two swings in his shooting, he was on the ground. He said he landed right next to his aircraft, which was a ball of fire.
We'll get back to Harry Zinsser's account shortly, but if we're going to talk about that downed pilot, why not talk to that downed pilot, Jim Lloyd?
By the time we went, we call feet dry into North Vietnam, it was dark. We got up to the area. The AAA, the anti-aircraft fire was spotty, and I thought this is going to be a piece of cake. We'll be done in an hour and get back to the ship and watch a movie, take a shower, get a bite to eat before going hitting the rack. I rolled in on a 45 dive delivery, and incidentally, when you're flying at night, at least back in those days, you obviously have your lights off, and you can't see each other either. So you talk to each other and keep tabs. Try to keep quite a bit of separation for obvious reasons. So I'm not sure if he was facing away or facing toward me. I rolled in and I pulled off, and I rolled over to evaluate my hit so I could report it to the ship when I got back. When I got the bomb was going off on the trucks, and I got an indication in the cockpit of it being painted by the fansong. I got the warble. I got the SAM alert light, and then it changed to the warble. And then I looked off to the distance and the direction that it was pointing to, and I could see about 10 miles away a big fireball arcing up to the dark sky and coming toward me. And I tell people, remind them that at night the human eye doesn't have very good depth perception, and if I turn too soon, it would give the SAM, it's coming up now three times the speed of sound, an opportunity to arc with me. And if I waited too late to do it, it had a 500-foot kill radius, and so I might have been caught in that radius. And I was pumping shaft to confuse the radar, but when I saw this fireball just kept coming up at me, I could see a dark center in the middle of the fireball, which was the nose cone. I figured it's time to break. So I did break, and I could feel it screaming by me, missing me. But what I didn't know is they fired another SAM from behind, and my ECM gear that it was making the noises was going to give you just one indication if it's one or more, and I didn't know about it. And it blew up next to me, and it took off my left wing. The plane immediately went into a nose down, falling. I realized I got to get out, and we have a face curtain we pull down. And that's the preferred method because it straightens your back and it protects your face. Or if you're real, got to get out now and can't take your hands off the controls, you just pull the D-ring that's between your legs. I pulled it, and it seemed like forever, as nothing happened. Well, it was my state of mind, because in 0.2 seconds, the system sequence started, the canopy blew, and I started going up the rails. But what happened in my mind is I looked down to see if it hung up on my entered blackout suit on my G suit, and then the seat fired. And so I didn't realize at the time, but they gave me a double break up compression fracture of the neck when I went out. As I left, all I remember is a sudden rush of air, the red instrument lights pulling away. Then a second or two later, the plane blowing up, and I went horizontally over the, not, you know, right at the edge of the fireball, swung twice, and landed at a big, hard landing, but I landed and didn't break anything.
Just one quick question there. You said something I want to zoom in on here. Right after you ejected, the plane blew up. So if you had waited another second or two to pull that D-ring, you wouldn't be here?
I wouldn't be there. Even if I got out, then I'd be out of the safety envelope of the seat. I mean, they're tremendous seats, and the engineers that put them and design them together and put them together do a tremendous job, but they got their limits. You got to give it a little bit of a opportunity for it to get you out. And a guy my size, 185 pounds, 6'2", is probably 200 feet, 250 feet. It blows you up if you're just sitting on the ground. So it's a pretty good kick in the seat. And then you got air bladders that push you away from the mechanical metal seat as you come out, and then your parachute opens if you're below 13,500 feet automatically. You try to beat it in case there's a malfunction, but it happens so fast. They're miracles, those seats. They get you out.
What was your estimated altitude when you ejected?
Well, all I remember seeing 2,000 feet screaming through the altimeter, and that'd be 2,000 feet above sea level. I have no idea about how high off the ground. I'm guessing it might be anywhere from 50 to a couple hundred feet, the elevation of the ground. There wasn't any mountains below me. It was all open rice paddies and fields. So I was probably around a little less than 2,000 feet above the ground when I got out, but things happen so fast.
And that's less than ideal.
Less than ideal. I actually, looking back, I thought I'd be out of the safety envelope of the seat.
And so you said you swung twice and hit the ground.
I hit the ground on a swing and knocked the wind out of myself. I don't remember getting out of my parachute, my helmet, or the seat pan. That's the survival pan that stays with you after you separate from the metal seat. And I just remember running. The fireball was right there, so it was cooking off the 200 millimeter. My two machine guns were popping off. I was afraid of any of the surviving 500-pound bombs that go off, which got a 3,000-foot kill radius. So I had to get away from those. And then also the light of it was just giving me away. And as I ran, I have no idea how far I went. I got down behind a little clump of what I refer to as razor grass. It was real sharp grass, about 2-3 feet high, and squatted in it and just sort of tried to assess the situation. There was literally 100, if not more, North Vietnamese coming out of the village just screaming and yelling. And I have no idea how many were the paramilitia, how many were villagers, and a lot of the villagers were armed anyway, and how many were the soldiers. But they were all over the place in the open fields. But it was very, very dark. Another miracle for me. And I got behind this little clump of grass and tried to assess the situation. I put mud on my hands and face to cut the skin tones, and also the mosquitoes were terrible. I remember I thought I saw flashlights coming, and one flashlight would be over with. But there were fireflies, big fireflies up close that I was thinking might be lights in the distance. And talk about a relief. So I finally got one of my two radios out of my flight gear and called up Art, who was overhead. Of course, he knew from when you eject, you send a beeper coming off your seat. It goes on every radio frequency. It tells him that I got out, but it doesn't tell him if I made it out or if I'm killed on the ground or whatever. And I told him I was alive. And I had literally people 6 feet and look, stop and look right at me, and I'm in the open, and they wouldn't see me. Anyway, when I had a chance, when they move around looking, I called him up and told him I was alive. He said that Lieutenant Commander Bernie Smith, who was our ops officer, was another tremendous pilot, was inbound to help him. So Bernie, I could hear him on the radio calling me on my little handheld radio, but he could only hear static when I called back. So he said, "Jim, Mike, key me in. Left, two, right, one." And well, he had his lights on, and he's flying low and very fast, and everybody was shooting at him. I was really surprised. Not only there were more people there than I thought, but there were also, seemed like everybody had some kind of a firearm. And they were shooting at him, and I mic'd it, keyed him in, and then when he was overhead, I told him, "Okay, you're overhead now." And he was either being painted by radar from a destroyer or one of the E-2 surveillance planes that we had flying over the Gulf, or the South China Sea. They never went overland. He told them, and they're watching him, so they had a rough idea where I was. We didn't have any of the fancy gear we have today with GPS, the satellite imagery, and any of that kind of stuff. And then I told him to turn his lights off. I didn't want any company down there. They told me that a helicopter was coming in. And I looked around. I wanted to get out of there so bad. I was emotionally a wreck. But I told him, I said, there's no way a slow mover is going to survive this. And so I said, turn them back. I'll have to call it went in later. I got to move. I was going through shock. You know, 1 minute I'm flying an airplane. It was comfortable cockpit, familiar cockpit, a shower and an hour and a half away. And now I'm in the enemy's backyard. I was 150 miles north of DMZ, 21 miles in from the coast, in an area I was told when I got back that no Americans were ever seen again that went down that area. Wide open spaces and people all around.
A seemingly impossible situation for that downed pilot, Jim Lloyd, as it was for that helicopter tasked with trying to rescue him. It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come, and there's a lot of information available for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode focusing on an incredible rescue mission in North Vietnam a half century ago because the helicopter pilot who was awarded the Navy Cross as a result is about to experience a very different kind of mission, his honor flight to Washington, D.C. Make sure to check out the upcoming honor flights wherever you live. I have links for you at hometownheroesradio.com. And if that happens to be in Central California, you can join me in welcoming home helicopter pilot Harry Zinser and 68 other veterans from Vietnam, the Korean War, the Cold War, and even World War II on September 13th at Fresno Yosemite International Airport. Get there by 5:30 to find a good spot. The plane should land by 6 p.m. and they'll come marching through around 7. We're going to get back to his rescuer's perspective in a moment, but while Harry and his HH-3A helicopter crew were en route, that downed pilot they were searching for, Jim Lloyd, was in the middle of a nightmare very few of us could even fathom.
And so I told the A-7s, I said, my thinking was, bomb on the other side of the rice paddies. One of them went in, dropped 2 500-pounders, and they were just tremendously loud. I'd seen them going off, obviously, from the air for almost half a year, but boy, on the ground, they were terrifying, the noise and the shockwave. But the light scared me the worst because it lit me up. I could see people's faces and everything all around me looking that direction. I said, knock it off, it's not going to work. I had been in that area for about an hour, and I, like I said, it was probably 9:30, 10 o'clock at night now, and I had to get out by daylight. There's no way somebody like me could hide in the daytime. So I'd been watching 11 North Vietnamese about 40 yards from me, and the reason I know there are 11 of them is I assigned each one a number so I could keep track of them, because I don't want to get on the radio and have one or two of them close by and hear or see me. When they all be clumped together, I talked lowly on the radio. Well, I made sure they were all clumped together, and I said I got to move north. And the only reason I went north is because it just seemed to be quieter. So I slowly snuck away, leaving the voices behind me. When they disappeared to silence, I took off at a dead run. And I went up probably an eighth of a mile, maybe a quarter of a mile, and got down to call them and tell them I was on the move. And what I did, I made an almost fatal mistake. I took my two survival radios, two water bottles, took them on my survival gear, my vest, because the vest was making all kinds of noise, and I dumped the vest and tucked the water bottles and the radios in my Anna blackout suit and my pant legs, and they'd slipped out, all of them. And without a radio, there was no rescue. And so I slowly turned around, and I worked my way back. There was clumps of grass and all over the place. There was people all over the place. Well, I used the voices of those 11 men that I left behind to vector me into the same little spot, the same little clump of grass that I'd been hiding in. I couldn't see. It was so dark. And I groped around with my hands, and my right hand came across the stronger of the two radios. I would have course taken either one of them and retreated a second time.
And let me stop you here, because this is the part of your story that I think gets me the most. And I'm interested to hear from you later which element of it is the most mind-blowing to you. But as I try to put myself in your shoes, if I've left this hiding spot behind, I'm trying to get away from these guys, it's pitch black, I have no idea where anything is, and then I realize I lost my radio. I don't think I would have had any reasonable expectation or hope of recovering it in that situation. What told you that you could actually do this and go find that radio again?
You know, that's an interesting question, because, you know, at the time, I just figured I'd find it. I look back through the years, and that's one of those what-ifs that really, really I find scary, you know, because I can't imagine going the rest of the night without a radio, knowing that daylight is, it was like being executed at dawn. When the sun came up, you were gone. And there was no hope for rescue, and the sound of the planes would disappear, because they would assume that I was either killed or captured, and they're not going to risk any more planes in such a dangerous area if they don't have any confirmation that I was still alive and still free.
So that moment when you're groping around in the dark and your hand grabs a hold of that radio again, what emotionally, what did that feel like?
Well, it was obviously a feeling of relief. You know, if that was the end of it, that would have been even really a greater relief, but it was just the beginning of the next steps. But at least I had hope. And I never left that radio again. I didn't tuck it anywhere. I never left my, I didn't even switch hands with it. I had a grip on that until the last minutes in North Vietnam. So I continued moving, and I'd be out in these rice paddies, and the water is probably 8, 12, 24 inches deep. It varied. Real slimy bottom, real slimy. And I'd fall down in the water, make all kinds of racket, and I'm moving away. There's people around, but not right around me, because I'm moving away from them. And I just wanted to get out of there. Heading north, I had a little wrist compass. I thought, I can't do this. It's just making too much noise. I got to find some way to travel quieter. Well, I realized that these partitions between rice paddies are a few feet wide, and they're high and dry. And I got on those, and God, I could make a really good time. I was quiet. I'd be hunkered down low to look up against the dark sky to see any light clothing so I could see anybody that might be approaching before they see me. And I was doing this for close to an hour when I heard, I was in the middle of two rice paddies, and I heard voices coming, noise. And I looked back, and two soldiers were on the same partition I was on, walking toward me. And I couldn't run. If I got in the water, they'd hear me splash. I just crawled to the side as far as I could of that little partition. I laid down in the prone position, held my breath, and I prayed. And I felt them walk by me. Then they stopped. A question was asked in Vietnamese. They walked back, and they stood over me. And then they jabbed me in the back with a rifle. And that is a feeling I can't even put in words of how hideous that feeling is. Again, Sear taught me I didn't want to be caught. And I was in a bad situation before, but I was free, and it was all over. And the thought came to my mind, I'm okay. I didn't know I had injured my neck, but I was still very mobile. I'm just going to lay here. They're going to have to carry me. Well, they jabbed me a second time, and when I didn't move that time, they argued. They started arguing. And then I heard which I thought was one running off, and then I could hear another group of soldiers about 40 yards off. I thought the individual was running too. And I figured now is my only chance. There's one guy standing over me. So I mustered all the courage I can get and rolled over as fast as I can to grab the guy's gun, fully expecting to be shot. And I was alone. And I remember my feeling was 95% relief and 5% foolish. I just thought, what if I just laid there not knowing they were gone? They had both run off not knowing, thinking that I was going anywhere. And I went, probably they were competing for credit. Well, they only went about 40 yards and told the guys that they found my body, I guess, Well, I got up and took off, and I ran down that partition. They couldn't see me, but they could hear me, and I could hear them shooting, and they all were firing in my direction. And the bullets were random, because some of them came real close to my ears, other ones thumping in the mud. I got down to the end of the rice paddy, and they were chasing me on the same little partition. I made a 30-degree angle cut, and they went straight, and I lost them. All I said on the radio was, "You can't believe what I just went through." So I had to continue going.
Let me stop you there for a second, because we can't believe what you just went through either. And there's a couple elements of that I want to add to. So you said the two Vietnamese soldiers, you believe, were arguing over credit, because they could be rewarded financially if they brought you in.
I was told that we were, as officers, we were worth $500 if we were captured alive. You know, that's a lot of money for them. I like to think I'm worth a little more than $500, but hey, I can't argue. But anyway, and again, because they jabbed me in the back and I didn't react. So they figured I was incapacitated. So they weren't worried about me escaping.
And you mentioned how awful that feeling was. Can you help describe that for us, what it felt like when they jabbed you in the back? It's more than physical pain you're talking about.
Oh, yeah, it's emotional. It's a feeling of being caught and, you know, by the enemy. You know you're going to be in the mercy of the enemy. They could do whatever they want to you. I knew in that area that I was a little too far from Hanoi Hilton. I probably wouldn't survive. I wouldn't be around much longer. They'd probably just execute me right there. And so I just figured it was over with. I had nothing to lose. That's why I was able to roll over, you know, get the courage to roll over and face that gun and hopefully knock it to the side and see what happened. I lost my .38, unfortunately, when I took off my survival vest. And as it turned out, that was probably a good thing because they would have heard it. But at the moment there, I wish I had it. I remember thinking about that. And then I just, like I said, I just took off at it. I can't believe how fast I was able to run to get away from all that.
And one more question before we move on to the next element of this saga. You said as you're lying there face down in the mud, they're jabbing you in the back with a rifle. But you said something. You said that you prayed. And I'm always fascinated by this. And maybe you don't even remember what you prayed. But when guys describe a situation like this, I try to say, well, what would I pray in that moment? What does a guy pray when he's in that helpless and seemingly hopeless of a situation?
Well, obviously, I'm praying for something good to come out of it. In other words, not to get killed, not to be captured, whatever. And I'm an average person when it comes to religion. I certainly believe, but I'm not somebody that pushes my beliefs down other people's throats or any of that kind of stuff. But the old saying is there's no atheist in a foxhole is very true. Your situations that by then I felt I was being looked after. I mean, there was no way that the decisions I made and the situations that happened would turn out in favor of me consistently like that, even up to this point. And it continued all night.
Yeah. And thank you for going there with me, because that fascinates me. And maybe other people get a hint of this in their life where they end up against something that they have zero control over. And I mean, if there's ever a situation where you're not in control, even though all these decisions you made led to your survival, it sounds like that's where you were in that moment, that there's not much else you can do and you need some help beyond yourself.
There was absolutely nothing else to do but roll over or, you know, and it was maybe my prayers were answered and it gave me the courage to roll over. Maybe I wouldn't have done that. And, you know, years later, decades later, I think back of that. And I think, what if I didn't get the courage to do that? I just lay there. Of course, they'd all be right there and got me. You know, and here I had a slim chance. And somehow I had the ability to take advantage of it. So it was good fortune.
Yeah. So you go from face down in the dirt with bayonets in your back to escaping these guys. So now, but you're still not free. And you know that there's only a few hours left. So what happened next?
Well, I'd be going through these fields. I would say I'm wading through a rice paddy. It's 2 feet deep. I hear off the distance, North Vietnamese. They'd be spread out and they'd be yelling. They'd be banging things. I thought I heard my name being called. I don't know if that was that or it was a Vietnamese word that sound like it, but I want to emphasize the human mind and body is absolutely phenomenal when it's pumped up like that with adrenaline and you're going through a life-threatening situation. I could hear everything. I could sense everything. I'd see them coming and I'd hold my breath when they got close, duck down in that putrid water. I'd literally feel them walking by when I couldn't hold my breath anymore. They didn't know I was there. They were looking for me. When I couldn't hold my breath anymore, I'd slowly come up and I'd see them walking away from me. They went by me. Again, one of them could have stepped on me and found me, but that didn't fortunately happen. And then I would continue on, and I did that several times during the night. I started feeling then as you know, I may get out of this. There's just too many things that are going my way just for it to end in failure. And I just want to mention the putrid water. The North Vietnamese fertilized those fields with human excrement for centuries. And basically, the analogy I use is I spent the night hiding in the basement of an outhouse. But it was the only cover I could find, and it's certainly the better of the alternatives. So anyway, after a few hours, I was really getting nervous. It was about daylight coming. It was about 2:30 in the morning. I got to a sort of a dry spot, and I pulled out my radio. I heard planes all night. They were flying all night. I called out on the radio, and I said, I think this is as good as it's going to get. It's kind of quiet here. You can go ahead and try to bring the helicopter in. I sat down. I remember slumping down. And my adrenaline started leaving me, and I literally ached from one end to the other. I was tired. I was worn out. Again, the adrenaline was a real shot in the arm, and I was losing it. The 2A7s that were over there flew 5 hours for me and refueled, air-to-air refueled several times to be there for me, and that's a long, long time for a single-seat aircraft that we flew. Now, an A6, the Truder, which is two people, the commanding officer of the squadron, Commander Ernst, and his Lieutenant Commander Grady Jackson, his bombardier navigator, took over command, unseen command, and they were overhead. And I remember saying, go ahead and bring them in. And one of them came back and said, Roger, Jim, it'll be 30 minutes. Just take it easy. And I thought, oh, take it easy. Well, one of three things is going to happen, and two weren't good. One was either in 30 minutes I'm going to be killed, or in 30 minutes I'm going to be captured, or in 30 minutes I'm going to be rescued. And I thought, wow, this is going to be exciting. And I just turned 27 6 days before, and I realized that, you know, there's a good possibility that in a half hour, I might not get any older. So that, with the adrenaline going, despair started to take over. And I want to just emphasize one thing that I learned. Despair is the worst thing that could ever happen to you. That's like, there's no hope. It's all over with. I can't help it. You know, you lose it. Fear, on the other hand, is one of your strongest allies. It hones your thinking, your instincts. You become an animal. As I mentioned, I'm so thankful that I was able to do that, and fear was one of my driving forces. And I found a big difference between the two. Well, despair was starting to hit in. I started to hear planes flying over. They were starting to stack up. They were getting ready to come in. With the sound of the planes, the North Vietnamese would hear that, and they figured that's where I was, so they moved. I had found out when I had called in, found out later through air intelligence, that I was exactly 2 miles from where I landed my parachute to where I was calling in for the helicopter at that point. I have no idea how many additional miles I made zigzagging to get there. But the fatigue was there. I mean, so when they started stacking up, I started thinking, I don't know how I'm even going to see the helicopter. My helicopter training was in the daytime in the jungle. How was it going to work at nighttime in the open fields with the enemy all around?
That is a very good question, and we'll get the answer from both Jim Lloyd on the ground there behind enemy lines and from Harry Zinser, the helicopter pilot who risked his life to save Jim's, when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and the incredible rescue story that unfolded in North Vietnam in the dark of night, August 6th, 1972, in the early morning hours of August 7th, a day that neither Harry Zinsser nor Jim Lloyd has ever forgotten. If today's episode touches your heartstrings, maybe you want to find your way to Fresno, California on September 13th to welcome home this decorated rescue pilot from his honor flight to Washington, D.C. I have all that info for you at hometownheroesradio.com. And as we hear the conclusion of this incredible story, we're going to bounce back and forth between rescuer and rescuee. And we'll start with the perspective from the helicopter with Harry Zinsser.
So we go in. Our crewman reminds me, he says, sir, he says, we still have our coverage of materials on board. I said, that's okay, Smetsky. So I'm ski. I said, it's okay, ski. Leave them right there because we're going to come back. Tell me later, he said, they gave him all the confidence in the world. I said, don't throw the materials overboard. So we go over to North Vietnam with confidence of materials on board. We have our personal gear and everything. I was going to throw my personal gear overboard. So we head over land. He clicks the mic. He says, sir, would you say a prayer for us? They realize that these guys are guys that live in bars, our crewmen. They live in the bars. They didn't drink anybody under the table. He asked me to say a prayer. I said, I've already prayed once, but I'll pray again. Click the mic and I prayed to the Lord to protect us. And sure enough, he did. So as we go over land, I expected all hell to break loose as soon as we crossed the beach. I reported feet dry. He drives when you cross the ocean, go from over the water, you go over land. Well, feet dry, man, said all hell to break loose. We want a single shot fired. See anything coming at us? Yeah, we're just north of the bend. Then I saw a ridge line up ahead, Karst line. And the words came to me from Psalm 121, where I had memorized Psalm 121 from our coaching and principal's class at Wheaton College. It says, I'll look unto the hills from whence cometh my help. My help come from the Lord, which made the heavens and the earth. I saw those hills, I saw that verse came right to my mind there, like I had a HUD display on it.
So we've been talking about there's a pilot, he needs to be rescued, you guys needed gas. There's a lot of things that can go wrong here. But now you're coming over land, low, so surface-to-air missiles can knock you out of the sky. And then I think your visibility isn't great either, right?
Right, the visibility is getting reduced, the cloud layer.
But you see these hills, this karst, 3,500-foot plateau, and the first thing you think of is a verse you learned in a coaching class in college?
Yes, it's amazing how that happened. The last part of that verse said, he that keepeth Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep. He'll guide your foot, and your foot will not move. I looked down on my boot, and I started just to light the cockpit, and there's one peanut bulb. I had a light on it, and it was shining on my boot. Shall not suffer that foot to be moved. I looked at my foot that night, and I saw it. I believe that light shined right on my boot. My boots going to stay there all night long. And I looked up several times in the rescue, and I saw the light shining off my boot.
I don't want to put words in your mouth. I want to understand what the significance of that is to you. So when you look at your boot not moving, that represents the mindset that you had in that moment?
Yes. Just renewed my confidence that the Lord was with us, and he's going to bring us out of this. He's going to bring us through this.
So you've got how many people on board this helicopter?
Four people on board the helicopter right now.
Yourself, your co-pilot, two crewmen. You've got a pilot on the ground whose life is in your hands. And then you mentioned you have all your personal materials and classified information that if the enemy gets a hand on it, could wreak a lot of damage, right?
Or gets in a lot of trouble, that's for sure.
The stakes of this mission are pretty high.
They're building up now, yes, they're building up now.
So what happened next?
So we go over land, and we now have to make an IFR descent. We're 3,500 feet across the ridgeline. But there's now a cloud layer. There's a black night now, it's a cloud layer. We have to get below those clouds. So we set our radar altimeter 200 feet. We're going to spiral descent down through the clouds. We break out through the clouds before we hit 200 feet. As soon as we break through the clouds, we see a pencil flare go off. So man, this is going to be a piece of cake. Found a haystack, now we're going to find a needle in a haystack. We just found a needle, so we thought. So we head for it. Our NC commander, he says, hey, get out of there, big man. It's a trap. It's a trap. Get out of there. So now we figure, oh crap. So we pull in power. We had reset our radar altimeter to 30 feet. Our radar altimeter is a Ross warning, sitting over below 30 feet. So I turned on a spotlight just in time because there's a grove of trees ahead of us. It's about 100 feet high. We're at 30 feet. We're just in time pulling power. We cross over trees. We went over trees. I looked out my left window. I see a guy pointing, aiming a gun at us. We had our spotlight on. And I see muzzle flashes going off. Scared the heck out of me. So we banked hard to the right, banked hard to the right. Then Jim comes up on the radio and says, I'm at your six. We actually passed over him. We didn't realize we had passed over him. We did.
Jim is Jim Lloyd, the pilot who had gone down. You two have been friends ever since, but at this point, you've never met him. So you hear the pilot saying, I'm at your six. That means he's behind you.
That's right. It means we just passed over him. Mm-hmm. So we're turning around. He says, I'm at your six. I'm at your six. As we're turning, we see I see a figure of a guy running. He's got his arms crossed like this. He's in an American flight suit. So I figure that's him. He says, come right 10 degrees, big mother. So he turned right. He said, no, you're the right. And that's a common mistake that pilots make.
Because it was his right, but not your right.
Yeah. But we know exactly what I meant, because that's what happens. That we just search and rescue train at Fallon, Nevada. That happens at Fallon, Nevada all the time. So we learned that. So he said, you're the right. And there's exactly what I meant. So he came there. Now he's scared because now I said, show a light. He said, show a light, damn it, show a light. He's afraid to turn on his light because his light, he has a strobe light, but it's sewn into the collar. Now he's got to show a light, so he didn't want to show a light. But I said, hey, man, if you want to get rescued, you got to show a light. So he finally turned the light on, and saw a strobe. As soon as the strobe went on, about four of the strobes went off immediately, went off in the area. So they were watching. My second crewman was behind me. He said, sir, he says, there's the first strobe that went off. Sure enough, that was him.
So I just want everybody to understand, you know, what you guys are dealing with. He turns his on, and then immediately four others go on. So for you, in the dark, you could have picked any one of those five. You got an 80% chance of picking the wrong one and dying.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
But because one of your crew members saw the first one and knew where it was, that's where you went. Yeah. Were you at all hesitant to go to that one?
No, because we saw him running. So we headed that direction, and then we saw him running. So it was him then.
He spotted me and he went off about 100, 200 yards from me and went into a hover and I just took off. Well, it sounded like I had the whole North Vietnamese army on behind me. My night vision was gone because I was looking in that landing light. I couldn't see him, but I could hear him. And I just, as fast as I could run, he was in a hover. Of course, the noise now was deafening. Again, I didn't have a helmet on. I was getting beat up by mud and rocks, and we had a snap link on our torso harness that we hooked onto the cable, and I hooked on, closed my eyes, and waited to be hauled up, and nothing. And I looked, and the helicopter was sitting right next to me in the mud. He had landed to get below a deflection angle of the AAA gun, a 37mm that was right next to him, and he had to get below it before he was shot down. In fact, one of the A6s overhead later said they saw that the guns going off, and then the lights of the helicopter going out, and they thought they shot it down. Well, the North Vietnamese thought they shot it down, too. As I went to jump in the helicopter with the weight of the cable on top of me, of course, I was completely worn out by then, and then he was holding power to keep from sinking in the mud, so his struts were extended, so it was about neck high, the deck of the helicopter, and I went to jump in and knocked myself the wind out of me. Just then, the gunner was standing over me shooting. He stopped shooting, reaches over with his outstretched hand, and I could see his face in the dark. And then he's saying, come on, come on. And that, I can say, that image I'll never, ever, ever forget. I could have been on the moon and not felt any more further away from home. And here, there was this American pulling me in the helicopter. He grabbed the back of my flight suit and pulled me in. In the meantime, since the helicopter landed, turned the lights off, as I mentioned, the North Vietnamese thought they shot it down. And so they were storming the other side, and Matt Szymanski held them off. He said years later, I was laying them down like cordwood. The helicopter took off. I remember it vibrating real bad from the strain of the engines and pulling off, and we had 21 long miles to go to the coast. They were jinking to keep from being hit. You know, I didn't have any safety lanyard on like the gunners did, but I'd be jinking. I was afraid of being thrown out the open door, so I lay on the floor, afraid I'd be got shot to the floor, and I was going through shock again. And one of the gunners grabbed my arm, set me in a seat, strapped me in, off we went. And right before we got to the coast, two fireballs went about 30, 40, 50 feet from us.
Jinking has been over. It was designed that if you jink at the right time, if you place a crewman at the back and he sees a missile coming at you, he calls breakdown, a heat-seeking missile. You jink, or left the missile miss you. Mm-hmm. So I just had a gut feeling, let's jink. So I jinked to the right, and a missile goes by us on the left side. Of course, it's, geez, they're shooting missiles at us. Jink the other way, sir. So stand by, ski. I jinked to the left, and another one goes by us on the right. They're usually fired in pairs. Mm-hmm. We did not know that. Had I jinked a second or two later, we wouldn't be here today. Then we crossed the Kursk line, and we did all rotation down to about 200 feet. We didn't want more missiles fired at us. Then we were at the water. Then we were at the water's edge line and reported feet wet. It's amazing. There were six aircraft that reported right in the order. I imagine they went in order seniority. They ate Big Mother, Sierra Hotel. Good job. And now we had to get gas because our little fuel lights had been on for about 15 minutes. So then we had a good 5 minutes of gas left. We started to gradually climb up a little bit higher. And it was, sure enough, they brought a ship into us. This is Cleveland. The LPD had a big deck on it. We landed there.
There's a lot going on there. I didn't live this, you did. But when you are staring at limited fuel and not knowing if you're going to make it to a ship in time to fuel up, is there some kind of thought or conversation about, we've been through all this and now we're going to run out of fuel?
Yeah, that certainly goes through your mind. And that's what I thought about. You measure fuel very closely.
And then one of the gunners grabs my shoulder and points down, and I can see the breakers of the North Vietnamese coastline. We were feet wet. As I say, a savior of the naval aviator. At least if we went down, the Navy would get us if we survived the crash. But we landed on the Cleveland. I didn't even know what kind of ship it was. Shut down, and that's when I met the crew the very first time, who became lifelong friends. And I got out of the helicopter. The commanding officer of the ship and his medical officer came up to shake my hand and jumped back. Like I said, I must have looked the sight, and I smelled a heck of a lot worse. Anyway, we found out we'd had 13 holes in the chopper. The sponson was shot off. There was a crease in the tail rotor, and they had way less than 5 minutes of fuel, which is nothing. I mean, those gauges aren't even accurate for probably 10 minutes of fuel, plus or minus. So that was another miracle.
Obviously, you've had a lot of time to think about this. You've written it up. You've seen what Jim's written. You two talk every year on the 6th of August. Is there a moment or two within that whole ordeal that you still think about and marvel and say, how in the world did that happen that way?
Oh, yes. I still remember very vividly. We were looking out the left side after the turn on the spotlight. Well, the guy standing there aiming at us with his gun. Said muzzle flash is going off. And I had a picture, a lot of the light shining on my boot. The Lord saying, he shall not suffer thy foot to be moved. Told he that keepeth Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep.
Something tells me you probably never looked at that passage, Psalm 121, the same either.
That's right, yeah.
That kind of makes it come alive a little bit.
Sure does, yes.
And what did it feel like when you finally went to bed that night? I mean, because that's, you know, everybody can identify with that. The end of a long day, what do they think of? What do they reflect on? Do you remember what you reflected on that night?
Well, we landed our skipper. He had landed on the ship first, so he was there waiting for us. Remember, he hugged us. Hey, skipper, put me down. He hugged me. He kept hugging me. I felt a little embarrassed, you know. Skipper, put me down. And then we all went in the wardroom. Jim Lloyd, he went in too. And he came out, and then he was in a set of PJs. We just celebrated that night for a couple hours in the wardroom. It was picked the helicopter the next day. We had a total of 12 bullet holes in the helicopter. One shot at Razor Terror Drive Shaft. Had been a couple inches lower, we may not be here either.
So 12 bullet holes in your helicopter, and one of them was in the tail rotor's crankshaft. So if that was just a very small amount higher or lower, that would have knocked you guys out of the sky or made it so you couldn't control it?
Yes, it would have been a little bit lower. It just grazed the top of the turbo drive shaft.
Well, and I know that you've done a lot of teaching in your life. I mean, you spent 26 years in the Navy, and then when you retired, you started the junior ROTC program at Lemoore High School near NAS Lemoore. And so you taught a lot of future naval officers. I'm wondering what August 6th, 1972 taught you, because that's an experience. That's one day in your life that you've probably spent more time talking about that day than any other day in your life. What was the lesson of that day? What did it teach you?
Well, the big thing it taught me was the Lord was with us that night. He certainly was. People ask you, were you scared? Well, you're not scared at the time. You're so busy.
Well, and you say that, you know, that's what it taught you. So I'm just wondering if there are other things in the 50 years since that maybe you faced with a different degree of confidence because you were able to get through that night.
I think so. It makes you put other things in perspective, I think. Like, you don't worry about the small stuff anymore.
I would say for anybody, believe in yourself. You'd be amazed at what you could do. And if it's an overwhelming obstacle ahead of you, just remember, if you eat an elephant, you eat an elephant a bite at a time. You just one step at a time to get through it. Believe in yourself. You could, if you really want to do something, you can.
Well, maybe, just maybe, there's a little perspective there for the challenges in our own lives. Rescuer Harry Zinser, rescuee Jim Lloyd. You'll find a lot more to explore with both of them at hometownheroesradio.com. And if you do live close enough, come join that cheering throng to welcome Harry home from his honor flight September 13th in Fresno, California. The 68 other veterans aboard that flight include Purple Heart Marines, decorated fighter pilots, and everything in between. And wherever you're listening, there's likely an honor flight with the same kind of humble heroes, never asking for anything, but receiving more than you realize when you just offer up a simple thank you for their service to our country. That's all the time we have today. Thank you for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.